In just a moment,
keys to the Capitol. But first, you're keeping informed the thorough and accurate way if your radio dial is tuned to NBC all through the day. It's the very best in news coverage with reporters and commentators like Morgan Beatty, Pauline Frederick, Ray Henley, and Alex Dreyer, and many more. On NBC, you'll hear the news as it happens. You'll go behind the headlines for the inside stories, and you'll meet the
people whose
actions and decisions
make the front
page leads.
Keep in mind the easy,
the complete way.
The NBC
radio
way. And I'll stay there for
keys to the Capitol.
What's going on in Washington?
Is the United States getting tougher?
The whips are cracking?
No.
How? A filibuster. Filibusters grew up with the Republic.
From Washington, NBC News brings you transcribed Keys to the Capitol, a weekly news program in which the National Broadcasting Company's top Washington reporters and commentators discuss with you the news of the week and what's behind it. Tonight, you will hear Arthur Barrio, Leif Eade, Richard Harkness, and Earl Godwin. NBC News has given these men the weekly assignment of going through Washington's official doors to learn the background of our national policies. We bring you now Keys to the Capitol. And first, here's NBC Washington correspondent Arthur Barrio.
Now that our Navy flyers have shot down a couple of red Chinese planes in the Far East, the question is being asked, is this a sign that we're getting tougher? Actually, no. We've never been willing to have our service personnel attacked without fighting back, but coming as it does at a time when the free world has seemed to be salaming to the Reds in order to maintain peace, it appears on the surface to be a radical departure from the normal. It also is welcomed by many American citizens. In fact, if we took a survey right now, we'd probably find many Americans would want to bring these naval flyers home to pin medals all over them. These citizens are willing to let go hang those individuals in other countries who think we were a trifle impulsive in our actions. President Eisenhower has said our planes were not only where they should be, but were there on legitimate business. And he won't receive much criticism for his statement that we do mean to defend our rights. In the case of the Navy planes, we defended those rights most dramatically. While we're not getting tougher, we at the same time are anxious, obviously, to show the world we're not willing to be kicked around. In this particular case, our Navy is in a more favorable position to use forceful language than is the State Department. The Navy, in so many words, can tell its people, don't start anything, but if they come at you, fight back before they blow your head off. Perhaps the State Department many times has wished it could take a more forceful approach. But diplomacy being what it is, state is forced to resort to strong notes. These in the hope, however faint, that warnings will suffice. You can only go so far with notes, and you can send so many that eventually you get from the public the sarcastic reaction, well, goody-goody for us, we've sent another one. Well, that's why so many eyes popped in surprise when we heard about bullets. We also have heard lately the rather high-sounding diplomatic phrase, peaceful coexistence with vigilance. Well, this, it would seem, is a good example of vigilance. Perhaps the kind that, to be optimistic about it, eventually will make the Reds think twice before provoking other incidents. Well, that, as we said, is the optimistic view. No one knows exactly what the Reds will do to separate us from our allies. Here we have an example. The Reds apologize to the British for shooting down a transport, accuse us of carrying out barbaric attacks because our flyers defend themselves. Well, the Reds and the Reds alone know whether peaceful coexistence will be simply a phrase. But here, at least, definite action on our part. It's doubtful at this point whether we're any tougher. Perhaps it would not be a bad idea if we were to become so.
Well, I'd like to suggest, Barry, right along the line that you've been talking, that if there was ever a situation or an area loaded with military dynamite in it, it's the South China Sea where those bullets are buzzing around. Because what do you have? These attacks occurred just 12 miles south of the Chinese communist island of Hainan. The Reds have fortified that island heavily because that commands the Gulf of Tonkin and Indochina and even southeastern China. It's only a short haul up to Formosa where the Chinese nationalists are flexing their muscles. We're giving them more military strength. Chiang Kai-shek's staging some raids out of Formosa. And then it's not too far either from the Philippines, where our Navy decided to build just an airplane, I should say just a submarine base after World War II, and then more recently put in a big naval air base. It's a section of the world where the Chinese communists, the Chinese nationalists, and American military might are jammed up in this one South China Sea area. I think it's a very dangerous situation over
there.
Well,
Richard, it is very somewhat similar, except it's in the air, not in the water, to the armed ship situation in the Wilson's administration, where Woodrow Wilson asked Congress to permit them to arm American merchant vessels who were being fired on by German submarines and German warships in a somewhat similar way.
Yes, Mr. Roosevelt did that just prior to our entrance in World War II, as I recall.
He did that sort of thing, I make that statement because it is, as Art said, we're no tougher. We're carrying out somewhat similar policies at a different time.
I don't know whether we're not being a little bit tougher about this. This Pacific Fleet Commander, Admiral Stump, saying, be quick on the trigger, you know, when you read that and look at it. He says, even if there's come at you with hostile intent, well, now how do you know what guy's coming at? So you shoot if there's any doubt.
Well,
I think things are being a little bit tougher, and I think you can trace it back to the fact that we've taken a bad licking on the Indochina thing, and we're a little bit sensitive about the whole thing. We're not going to let them shove us around.
Well,
so we're taking a firmer line.
It's tougher than the Woodrow Wilson thing, because Congress wouldn't let him do it.
No,
but it's the same idea.
I think we're touchier and maybe a little bit quicker on the trigger than we were before Geneva.
Well, you know, that Stump statement reminded me of Admiral Bill Leahy in the Panay incident. He then said that when we didn't fire back at when the Jap machine gun, Bill Leahy said there are too many diplomats and too few sailors in this thing.
Well, I'm glad we've got not sailors, but pilots in this thing now. I personally think it was the only thing to do is stand right up there and fire back at them. I don't know how we could do otherwise without losing face completely in the Far East.
In the Far East.
I think as serious as it is, I think it came as a sort of shot in the arm to many American people. Here at last were the Americans fighting back and not merely... Well, kowtowing to the Reds, as it were.
I don't think it'd been more serious if we didn't fire back.
I do, too, because that would have meant just more of these kinds.
We would have been shoved around further.
Sure.
Because they did, they were feeling their international oats on after this Indochina thing. There's no question about it.
Well, that situation as it is, though, I suppose we can expect more incidents at any time over there.
Well, I'm not so sure there'll be more incidents because the Chinese are probably going to observe that 12-mile line a lot closer than they did before instead of stretching it out to 30 and 50 miles out to sea.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make. I would think with all that military might which is being piled up out in that part of the world for come what may, that future incidents are almost bound to happen. If you have planes flying around, the other fellow has planes flying around, there's going to be some shooting.
If they're going to both go in along the 12-mile line and no buffer zone, so to speak, so that the Chinese say, well, I'll go out to 12 miles and no further, and the Americans say, well, I'll go in as far as 25 miles. They've got a 10-mile zone, and even that's covered in no time with a jet plane.
I don't think it necessarily means war. You recall there's been a whole series of these plane incidents, even between the Russians and ourselves in Germany after the death of Stalin and when Malenkov took over. And we protested, and nothing came of it.
Well, speaking of getting tough, there have been some changes along that line on the domestic political scene, too, these last few weeks. You remember those let's-get-along breakfasts the president used to have for the senators and representatives at the White House? Well, they're mighty few and far between these days. But you can hear that old political bullwhip whistling and crackling around the congressional ears these last days of the congressional session. And the president and his men aren't even taking the trouble to disguise the fact that they're behind this hard disciplining of Republicans and the rough handling of the Democrats on the Hill these days. The best example of the whole 83rd Congress, of course, is the one just completed on the bill to revise the atomic energy law. Majority Leader Noland and the others of the Republican leadership held the opposition's feet firmly to the fire with all-night sessions, rough parliamentary tactics, even an attempt to apply the gag rule. There have been some pretty loud yells of pain and anger, but when Nolan came out of the White House last Monday, he said the president agreed with him that this was the thing to do. Over on the House side, the discipline has been so tough that the opposition didn't even get a chance to scream. Speaker Joe Martin and Majority Leader Halleck just lined up their majority forces, clubbed the opposition down, and jammed the bill through, and no amendments either. I don't think there's any doubt that the president's behind all this. There's a lot less sweetness and light out of him these days on that famous program of his, and a lot more pretty rough talking. For instance, his remark about those who voted down his federal health reinsurance idea in the House, you remember. The president said they just don't know the facts of American life. And in this week's news conference, he added an ominous remark that he'd be more than just bitterly disappointed if Congress goes home without making 6 administration bills into law. And you notice now that he's not a bit coy about making up a must list. So things have changed a lot. The atmosphere is charged these last days of Congress, but it looks as if the tough-talking, tough-acting policy is paying off. The president has got his farm bill well on the way through Congress. He's got his big tax revision bill through, the atomic bill, his appropriations bill is pretty much as he wanted them. And it looks as if he'll get practically all the rest, too, but he has had to get tough to get it. What do you think about that, Earl?
Well, I think you're perfectly correct. I wouldn't make any exceptions to anything you have said there. To tell you the truth, I thought you might be putting up an argument. I think you're perfectly correct on most of that stuff. And I think it has surprised a great many people, because it seems to me that President Eisenhower has been rather gentle himself, rather gentle and gentlemanly with Congress. He hasn't called him any names. He hasn't ridiculed him the way certain other presidents have done, Truman and Roosevelt. It seems to me that he has done something in the way of inspiriting that little group of leaders that gets up there Monday mornings. I think possibly he's put a little snake dust in their shoes at those early morning meetings.
Well, he succeeded in doing one thing. I think he succeeded in focusing the attention on his program as the issue in the November election.
Well, that's on too.
I was just about to say, Roger, isn't that an obvious factor in this? We have the elections coming up in November. And it's a case of perhaps presidential leadership, and also the fact that these gentlemen have to go back and face the constituents, and come November, when they're looking for the votes, they have to have a record behind them. They're bound to get on the ball, as it were, between now and the general.
Well, you remember it was only a couple of months ago when there was a question here in Washington of whether Joe McCarthy and the criticism of our foreign policy weren't going to take precedence over the president's program as the issue, the dominant issue in November.
Well, it isn't at all. I was up at the governor's conference at Lake George. Was it last week? Yes, I guess it was. 42 of the state governors there. I talked Joe McCarthy to almost half of them, at least, and not one of them thought that McCarthy was going to be an issue, pro or con, in the campaign. And in fact, several governors said a few fellows in Washington would just quit broadcasting and quit writing about Senator McCarthy, forget him altogether. They don't think that McCarthyism is any kind of an issue in this campaign. That proves that the president had that right canny political sense back when he first made that statement.
Yeah.
Remember, everybody hooted at it.
There has been a lot of confusion about it up to recent times.
That's right.
It's more of an issue in Washington than anywhere else, in other words, isn't that it?
Yes, I think it is. So, yeah. Since the hearing, McCarthy's been quiet since the CIA investigation he threatened failed to come off. He couldn't put that over. We're hearing a lot less about Senator McCarthy. I think in some states that he will be a rather potent issue, that some of the Republican candidates will want him into the states, and he probably will do some speaking, but not under the blessing of the Republican National Committee.
Well, there are many who'd rather not have Senator Flanders press this issue that's upcoming Friday.
Well, they don't want any split on it. Even if they're trying to play it down, they don't want to start any fight over this.
Well, if I know Ralph Flanders, that's going to be pressed.
He seems determined.
There's another thing, too. I
know
the president in his news conferences is saying that he's now having a check made, a sort of a preliminary check made before he endorses any Republican candidate for office.
That's right.
You know, that's not the way he's been talking up to recently.
He was talking for a while to give you the impression.
He's going to step in any Republican, but just in general, sort of.
He's like in the case of Cooper of Kentucky, who we said he thinks he's mistaken. He thinks Cooper's mistaken on the TV and public.
Sure, but he has a fine record of fine with the administration and so forth.
Well, I've never seen a president yet stay out of primary races. He just the
no.
very nature of it.
He wants his
leader,
own men.
He can't stay out of it.
Well, he's been doing that through, of course, he's been more intimate with the Citizens for Eisenhower committees than he has been with the regular Republican organization.
Well, I think he feels that if the Republican Party is going to continue as the majority party in command, that it must have that independent vote.
Yeah,
well,
there's sound political reasoning there. Yeah. It won't be much of a campaign
if Eisenhower keeps his mouth shut entirely now.
Well, he's not going to.
He owes a lot of these new Republicans in the House a lending hand because if they came in on his coattails, they've been lining up solidly with the, of course, the urging of Charlie Halleck and Speaker Joe Martin and a few arm twistings, but they have lined up solidly with him.
Well, I'd like to suggest that while we're talking about Washington this evening, that this week should go down as the week of the big wind here in the Capitol. Because finally, after 13 days of oratory, if you can call it oratory, the atomic energy bill filibuster came to an end. Now, what impresses me is not so much the hot air, because hot air is really a cheap commodity here in Washington, but the fact
that... Not even price supported, huh?
But the fact that how a filibuster is organized, it isn't just a hit-or-miss proposition in which a few senators get together and say, let's talk. These marathons are about as well-planned, actually, as a military expedition. Now, taking this more recent one as the example... The leaders in this Atomic Energy Talk Fest were Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee. He was dubbed the general. And then Senator Lister Hill of Alabama, who was also interested in the TVA versus public power issue, was nicknamed Lieutenant General. Now, Gore and Hill were just that, just what those titles implied. They deployed the members of their bloc like military men. Senator Anderson, just to take an example, was scheduled to hold the floor, say, from 6 until 10 o'clock in the evening. And Senator Eastland was held ready to take over and go until midnight, and always in reserve was Wayne Morse, a 12-hour man on any subject, or a 12-hour man without a subject, as a matter of fact. Gore and Hill then used amendments for ammunition. One amendment would be disposed of after a long all-night tussle, then the pair had another one ready to offer, and the debate would begin all over again, and so it went for those 13 days. Now, there was even the strategy of being absent from the Senate. To hold the filibusterer's nose to a grindstone, the administration must keep a quorum on hand or at close call at all times. So senators who were part of the filibuster bloc would sneak away. They'd try to hide from the sergeant-at-arms so that the Senate would have to recess. In the recent talkathon, to take one incident, Senator Anderson was dragged out of bed. He was escorted to the Senate, and he arrived in a state of high dudgeon, but he had to answer aye at that quorum call. Now, filibusters are conducted for varying reasons, of course. Sometimes a little band of senators know that they're whipped, that they don't have the votes, but it may be good politics back home to make a big fight. Other times, a filibuster serves to dramatize an issue before the country. Normally, it's an out-and-out endurance contest, however. In this recent spectacle, certainly, the object was to delay the administrative legislative program, the president's program that we were just talking about, to a point where the Senate leaders would holler, Uncle. But normally, it's the public which would like to call it quits. These filibusters are really amazing performances. You know, they broadcast and headlines about grueling, fighting, use a lot of action verbs and purple adjectives. I find them pretty dull stuff myself. Leif, you sat through one of the all-night sessions, didn't you?
Yeah, they are dull. I mean, there's the fellow over there who was appointed to sit in the majority leader's seat. He's usually reading a paper or wandering around talking with somebody else, trying to kill the hours, and the pages are sitting down on those steps leading up to the speaker's desk, and then the speaker up there is allowed to have his feet halfway up on the desk trying to stay awake, and the thing drones on and drones on, and you find somebody like Morse down there with his administrative assistant sitting right by him and handing him a paper now and then, and he reads it, reads a sentence from it, and then he makes a few comments and starts talking about that. And when he's finished with that page, which will take about 15 minutes, then he gets another page. And if he runs about out of that, then he makes some comments about the weather, the time, and his need for
There's no rule that requires relevancy in these.
No, none whatsoever. But there has been quite a remarkable degree of relevancy in the last couple of filibusters, even on the last civil rights filibuster. The Southern boys stayed on the subject of states' rights. Of course, that'll get a library full of stuff to talk about. And here, on the public power thing, there was they stayed on the subject. Ellender had to make a few political speeches since he's up. He was up in the primaries down in Louisiana. He had to talk about the farm policy, but in general, they stayed very much on the subject.
And he won it.
Yeah.
Thinking this last one, the most interesting incident up there was not the filibuster itself, but the spectator whistling at Senator Margaret Chase Smith when she showed up in an evening gown.
Yes,
that
and
night.
The cop in the gallery waking up spectators who were sleeping while the people on the floor were sleeping.
At least that was something different.
Well, actually, the spirit in a filibuster depends on how many people are in the galleries. Up until about midnight when the galleries are filled, if they were packed, actually. If this last filibuster, you got a pretty good show. Little ham in all these senators, you know. But then when people go on, get yawning, go on home, go to bed, the tempo of the talk dies down and becomes just sort of a... what do you call it? Strong back, weak mind. Endurance contest, I think.
If there was a little ham in the senators for a few people in the gallery, what do you think a televised filibuster would do to them?
Oh, I think it would be the most atrocious thing that you could inflict upon the American people.
Keep them going for weeks on that.
Well, you know, this the filibuster grew up with the Republic on this thing, and while the word, the term, and some of the technique is changed, in the last half century, we had a filibuster in the first Congress, and the subject, they tell me, was the location of the District of Columbia. They tried to talk something to death. They wanted it somewhere else. Wanted in Philadelphia and other places. Then they went on for 40 or 50 years for the next filibuster. They come more frequently than that now. Was Senator Benton of Missouri did not like the idea of Louisiana coming in as a state. Henry Clay and he fought and developed into a filibuster, and then they had another filibuster and talked for 10 days on firing the printers of the Senate. They used to print the record called the Congressional Globe for some of that. That was patronage. Then after the Civil War, of course, there were the Southern Democrats and the Southerners filibustered every opportunity they could against the Northern Republicans because of the repressive laws that they were trying to inflict upon the Southerners. And then along came the real type of filibuster we know today, 1908, I think it was, when the elder La Follette held the floor for 18 hours and 23 minutes against a Republican currency bill, which he thought was evil. But it wasn't only the liberals, minority folks, that conducted filibusters, because Reed Smoot of Utah, who was a Republican leader, he filibustered himself. He talked for 11 hours and a half against a ship purchase bill, the contents of which I've forgotten, but I know he did it. Well, the famous one that left a quotation was the Wilson's proposal to arm merchant vessels and protect Americans and their property on the high seas with the Germans loose and submarines, and that brought on that filibuster that killed the bill and led Wilson to make that remark about the little band of willful men representing no opinion but their own, and they rendered the great government of the United States helpless and contemptible. The leader of that filibuster had a picturesque name. You send a Stone of Missouri. They call him Gumshoe Bill. Then the rush for cloture began about that time in 1917 or in that. And they finally adopted that rule at that time by a good vote, 76-3. But it requires a vote of 2/3 of the Senate, as you know, and that's pretty hard to get, 66 votes on cloture in an outfit that wants to talk like that. Cloture means you can, from now on, every senator can talk for 1 hour, and after that it's over. That cloture rule brought an end to the filibuster of a very famous debate, the Versailles Treaty in 1919. But there are other ways of delaying. You don't have to speak all the time. I remember one time that somebody wanted to delay a vote, and he noticed that the chaplain's prayer had not been inserted in the record that morning, and he moved to insert it properly in the forthcoming record, and spoke for 2 hours on the subject. So, it doesn't have to be our kind of filibuster, but this new thing that they're now doing, I think, was brought in by Huey Long. I think he was the first guy that really brought in, and he brought in slapstick vaudeville, too. Remember, he talked about pot liquor and fried oysters, turnip greens and coffee, and McKellar got up and said that Huey Long was so unpopular he probably couldn't get support for a resolution to endorse the Lord's Prayer. Things of that kind. And then Morse of Oregon came along. I think he probably broke them all. He's broken them all with his 22 hours and some minutes when he was speaking only recently on the offshore oil bill. So I think it... of course, when Charlie Dawes was elected vice president, the first thing he did after taking oath in the Senate was to get up and denounce the rules, gave the Senate unshirted Hades on account of their rules that permitted filibustering, and he said he was going to take it to the country about. But another vice president, Adlai Stevenson, grandfather of our current Adlai, when he left office, he said the Senate rules are founded deep in human experience, and I suppose they're not going to do much changing about it.
You know, this has nothing whatsoever to do with the subject at hand of filibusters, but you're mentioning Stone of Missouri. Reminds me of, I think, my favorite Senate story, Earl, about old Tom Heflin was taking off in the Senate one day, and he was attacking I don't know what. He was always a man to make a florid speech. Seems that Senator Stone liked a little bourbon. He'd go out and have a drink, and he'd come in and heckle Heflin. Then he'd go out and have another drink and come back and heckle him some more. Finally, Heflin couldn't stand it any longer. And Heflin said, "Mr. President," he said, "I would like the record to show that at least when I come on the floor of this distinguished body, that I'm in full control of my mental facilities." Well, just at that moment, Senator Stone was going out through the swinging doors, you know, into the cloakroom, and he heard Heflin's remark, and he turned around without really losing a step. He replied, "Mr. President, what possible difference would that make?" I think that's my favorite story out of the years of the United States.
I will endorse it as being perfectly correct.
But getting back to that filibuster business and Huey Long, I'll never forget one night in the Senate. Huey came in. It was just for adjournment in the summertime, about as hot as it is now. And he had on one of those pongee suits, and he had on a purple silk shirt and a yellow necktie. And he just held that Senate enthralled that night. He not only gave the pot liquor recipe, Earl, but for some concoction, I don't know exactly what it is, called a Ramus Gin Fizz. Mm-hmm. But they're always, as you say, a vaudeville show when Huey Long took the floor of the Senate. And, of course, he had all. There was a very intelligent and able man.
The senators were
afraid to tie into Huey Long because he knew the rules and he knew how he could use the rules.
At that in that debate, somebody laughed up naturally laughed at Huey, and the presiding officer rapped on the desk and called order in the galleries. And Alvin Barkley arose and said that he ought not to do that because when people went to the circus, they ought to be allowed to laugh at the monkey.
Do you remember what Huey Long's comeback was?
No, I don't remember that one.
I'm sure that he had one. But I recall the night I was talking about when he was in that gaudy, flamboyant costume. He was filibustering against a pork barrel bill on rivers and harbors. And he finally beat it.
You've been listening to Keys to the Capitol, brought to you transcribed by NBC News as a way of taking you behind the doors of official Washington with NBC's top reporters and commentators. Tonight you heard Earl Godwin, Richard Harkness, Lee Feed, and Arthur Berrio. Keys to the Capitol will be brought to you at this same time each week. This is the NBC Radio Network.